Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. On today's episode, I was super excited to have with me Zeka Len. Zeka is general partner at Responsibly VC, a fund investing in sustainable and impact ventures at pre-seed. In today's episode, we talked about whether or not founders need to balance financial returns with social returns. What sort of metrics should sustainable businesses be measuring, if any at all? And how can we get more money invested into impact scale ventures? Let's get to it. Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I have with me via Zoom, Zeka Len. Zeka is general partner at Responsibly Ventures, a pre-seed VC impact fund backing remarkable teams focused on sustainability and social good. Zeka, really great to have you with me here today.
Thank you, Arish. This is so fun. I feel like I could talk with you all day long. It's great. Thanks for having me.
We can do like several pods, I'm sure.
Maybe co-host one or two.
It tends to be the problem I get with like most of our guests is like, okay, so when are we going to do round two? But look, let's start with this pod and right now.
Yeah.
You're both an environmental economist as well as a data scientist, right? Which makes you really well placed to invest in impact ventures from my perspective. Was it always your intention to move into VC, or was it more of an opportunistic transition back in 2021?
So it was an opportunistic transition. I wasn't actually quite aware of the world of venture capital and equity-based private markets around startup investing. I had kind of heard of it and thought of it. I kind of fell into it. In terms of my background from data science, and I was also an environmental economist. So for me, measurement around impact and in this area is very interesting. What I've learned mostly through the experience of being metrics and quantitative just by nature and as a programmer developer, I think about, you know, what can be systematized and turned into a process and measured and monitored and managed, all the rest. The one thing that I've learned most as a VC is how much that doesn't matter in the early stage. And it's not the most popular thing to say out loud, but I've reconciled that there are, if not thousands, of systems and certifications and schemes that involve impact, sustainability, social good, and all of them are valid. So I interviewed a couple of years ago, I had a podcast we did like 40, 50 episodes, and I got into live stream roundtables and such after that, did a couple hundred after that. But mostly when I was podcasting, I interviewed this gentleman named David Galipo, and he works from Haban Yunus in Thailand, and he worked for the UN and helped develop the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And so I'm certified also in the UN's Global Reporting Initiative, which is, in my opinion, the gold standard of CSR metric systems for global corporates. And with that, you know, ESG lens, David Galipo said to me in the interview, he said, you know, I've had all this experience with the SDGs and developing them, et cetera. He says, but Zeki, you really should understand that impact is personal. And when he said that in the podcast, I thought, that's kind of a silly thing to say. Impact is personal, but it unlocked something in my brain. And for a couple of years thereafter, I couldn't stop thinking about this. And in a good way, it led me to think about how all the different situations, why people do what they do, why teams do what they do, why people innovate. Why does some teams care about a problem more than what the market itself may necessarily care about right now? If a team has a vision about where a market is going, the customer may or may not have complete understanding of why they need to buy this solution. And that level of risk and understanding that's very personal to a team is very difficult to put under the normal lens of venture capital or early stage investing, where it's like, hey, what have you learned from your customers? What are they willing to pay? What's their early traction? So this gets into the world of risk. And so if impact is a form of risk and risk is not necessarily measurable under the same volatility constraint that we see in the public market or the same types of standardized metrics around risk, such as your debt to equity ratio or things like that, then the question is, should venture capitalists be taking a bet on these extra financial aspects that are risky? And I think there's a lot of debate about this. So, for example, you know, in the U.S., I don't want to get political, like I said, but in the U.S., you're seeing a lot of movement toward pension funds, in particular red states, which are banning ESG metrics in their portfolios, and perhaps they don't back fund managers that are early stage because we have a social lens or an ESG lens or an impact lens or something like that. Well, I think that's a mistake, actually, because
it's quite short-sighted, right? If nothing else,
it's very short-sighted because in the world, in the business of risk, you have to understand that these entrepreneurs are doing something that may never be done before. And when they're doing that, they're creating what we call in parlance, innovation. Mm-hmm. And then the question becomes, why does innovation matter? Well, if you're solving a pain for any individual or any group or any stakeholder community, then the question is, should we have people taking risk in terms of satisfying demands of groups? Well, I think yes. I think that's the public service of a venture, of an entrepreneurial pursuit. And in a free enterprise, that, again, I won't get political, but in a free enterprise where there are two voluntary parties who are making an exchange, that risk is being mitigated. And that's a wonderful thing. And when someone's willing to pay for it with semi-complete information or non-semi-complete information, then that creates the social good. And so that social good drives innovation, it drives employment, it drives a better future, in my opinion. Now, the question is, how should it be measured? Okay. Well, there really isn't one way. And sometimes, here's the thing that actually I'm going to say. I don't normally say this in podcasts. I've said it in some roundtables, but I say this quite often in different forums. I've written about it a little bit. Impact in the early stage and metrics regarding risk and extra financial measures sometimes is strategic to the positioning of a company.
Yeah.
Let's say, for example, carbon metrics. Now, should we require every small business and every mid-sized business and every large business to report on scope 1, 2, 3 climate emissions? My answer to that is that it depends. In public markets, I think every public company probably should be reporting on that. But in the private markets, sub $1 billion valuation, where it's hyper competitive and there are high correlations among things like your growth in carbon emissions and your financial outcome, I think that that would disadvantage many smaller companies, to be quite candid.
I mean, we're going to get into actually, it's quite interesting. You've kind of moved forward across a couple of the questions I had for you.
Sorry about that.
No, that's cool. Because I think this is the conundrum that we all face, right? Like, I mean, it's always been a question in my mind how one reconciles that need to drive outsized financial returns versus driving outsized social returns. For founders who are building in the impact space, and I guess for VCs investing in that space, right? So it always feels like you'll have to sacrifice one in pursuit of the other. How do you
think? That's the myth.
How do you think? Yeah, well, exactly. So how do you think about this question?
So this goes back to, it's like people arguing over what a word means. So if the word is stigmatized, and you have a background in linguistics, so I think you'll appreciate this. If the word impact has 5, 10, 50 groups arguing about what it means, then to settle the argument, if the word impact or the word sustainability is the target, then we all have to set up some set of rules about what sustainability actually means. Because of course we're putting government subsidies behind it, it's stakeholder dollars, etc. However, that urge to do that, to systematize metrics around one word to satisfy different stakeholder groups, I think it's an error of judgment. It's an error of thinking. And I'll tell you why. So my opinion is that having diversity of ideas about what sustainability means is a healthy thing for society. It creates innovation. However, there is a drawback when you don't have standards around it. For example, greenwashing. Greenwashing is, there are some legal cases around the world, maybe I'd say between 20 and 200 cases around the world, where there have been settlements and legal courses, cases, precedents around greenwashing. However, greenwashing in itself is very situational. There may be a company that operates in a more efficient, higher ESG environment that may have attributes of what they're not reconciling and reporting on that could be interpreted as greenwashing. Back in the 1980s, IKEA fell into this problem when there was a journalist who found one side table with a toxic glue in it when they were claiming that they were the most sustainable company on the planet around furniture. However, they more than likely were that company, but it blew up into such a sensation internationally that they quit all of their efforts in reporting on their internal sustainability targets, which of course are resource efficient in a sense. So that really didn't matter to them. They were going to be making the same bottom line. But there are some companies who are trying to do things that are extra financial for strategic purposes. And I think those are the companies that tend to get into the greenwashing problem. However, the companies that we back don't normally face those challenges because they're not trying to be the Tom Shoes that give away pairs to for marketing purposes or something like that. We look for companies that have the core aspects of their business which are more efficient to capture value.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of those topics which, again, like, you could skin in so many different ways, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, having spoken of founders who are, you know, maybe building in the health space or the education space, there's always that frustration because the vast majority of VCs, certainly here in the UK, in terms of kind of more generalist VCs, will often look at those types of endeavors, maybe less so in health tech after the pandemic and so on, but certainly in education and other kind of endeavors.
Yeah.
And they're almost automatically discounted. Maybe that's where kind of the seed for my question comes from, because, you know, they're almost always automatically discounted on the basis of, well, it's a social good, therefore it's not a venture
kind
of style.
Could we bounce off of this for a moment?
Yeah, for sure. 100%.
Oh, this is just the ed tech educational startups versus the healthcare startups. So this is fantastic you bring this up, because there is a narrative that's commonly brought into VC land where we're talking about ed tech in general. The sales cycles can be really difficult in the US when you're selling to larger administration. If you're selling to the administration, the life cycles are longer. But ironically, B2B SaaS types of companies also have to sell into the enterprise, right? So there's also a long sales cycle. The question then becomes, is this company, does it have a large enough TAM? Are there few enough competitors? That's where I don't know. You know, that's where I wouldn't make the claim. I like EdTech, frankly, and I think that there's a tremendous amount of impact that can be made through EdTech. I would never discount the opportunity set there. But I have seen this narrative where it's, this is not a big enough market. This is not going to be a massive enough exit, yada, yada. I don't buy it. You know, you got the Courseras, the Udemy's, the these types of platforms that have shown that these platforms can scale. There's presumably a 5, 10 billion plus market. Now, here's the thing, though. If a company is relying on subsidies, or if they're relying on a smaller market set, if your market is by default planned to be smaller, meaning you're not going to attack the Courseras or attack the Udemy's, if you're intentionally keeping your market set on, let's say, a problem that's incredibly important, but doesn't have a land and expand strategy, it doesn't have a venture plan, you're going to be throwing, like, this is what I saw scouting when I first started, that a lot of founders don't set the plan. They don't know what VCs are looking for. VCs are looking for massive markets, low competition, unfair advantages. If you have IP, that's great. But mostly we're looking, can you execute? Can you start to get early traction? Are you efficient with your capital spend, et cetera? And can you raise money? You know, are you the type of founder that's easily coachable? Can you move through the channel? Now on the health tech, I don't want to go, please stop me. I want to be the dialogue, but this is
what I'm here for.
Yeah. I mean, thank you. On the health tech side. So I'm going to be careful around health tech because I'm not, this isn't where I'm mostly focused. The health tech narrative tends to be more so focused around, in my opinion, now this is just my opinion, health tends to be more focused on what's the regulatory risk? You know, what does the FDA approval look like? Oh, also, frankly, it gets back to friction and selling into the enterprise or selling into the ed tech. This is, again, not advice to anyone, but just clearly saying these are my opinions. What I tend to see is I see that you have two things in health tech. You have regulatory risk. How expensive is it to get this FDA approval? Once you get it, what does it mean? How long will it take? Scares a lot of VCs. Also, sometimes, this is more psychological, but from this standpoint of impact investors, they tend to be a lot more sensitive to the negative externality. So if we're talking about health tech with pharmaceuticals, for example, there are human health considerations. And also there are personal considerations. If we back a company, we don't want to be part of something that's, you know, going to make our,
you don't want the next Theranos to be in your portfolio. I mean, like, essentially.
Right? Precisely. Yeah. Precisely.
Yeah.
And there's a technical due diligence aspect as well. So I struggle with that personally. You know, I don't have the resources to hire a team of PhDs. So I sometimes have to pass, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, look, I mean, you wouldn't be the first either. I fully agree. And, you know, those issues around, you know, in the UK, Europe, you have fragmented education as well as health kind of systems, which means your sales cycles, you know, you can't just attack one countrywide entity and deploy downwards. You've got to attack each of the ones separately. And, you know, often administrators change and then budgets change and all the rest of it. Look, I think this is precisely my kind of point around the difficulty when you're building impact ventures. I mean, one of the things that back in 2020, just as a pandemic hit, a few of us tried to lobby the UK government to set up a commingled fund specifically to focus on impact ventures, because we knew that those ventures struggled to raise venture capital in the first instance. And during, you know, the pandemic where everyone basically slowed down to zero, like these were the businesses that actually needed, not only needed funding, but also gave us, you know, massive opportunity to attack this problem, right? Like if you think about obviously the healthcare and the education implications that the pandemic led to or caused, you know, those are the businesses that needed to be funded. Essentially, the government went in a different direction, and thankfully, you know, we did see a lot more of those sort of businesses getting funded during that period. Until we kind of then dropped the ball and started investing in my favorite theme for this podcast, which is 15-minute grocery. But let's not get into that.
That's hilarious.
But you mentioned this. So funny. You mentioned this other issue. And I'm really glad you did, because one of the questions is, how do you actually measure impact, right? Because you recently published yourself an article citing 50 impact metrics that early stage founders could track, but changes in many of those metrics, right, like poverty, literacy, crime rates, civic engagement, etc., can only be seen over the longer time frame. So how do you know if the startup you're investing in...
Perhaps... I mean, I do see generally, I think you're correct in that, but that's perhaps. I mean, there.
Sure.
So one more time, the question.
Yeah. So I guess the question is, like, how do you, I mean, you started answering the question. How do you know if the startups you're investing in are actually achieving that real change or change at a pace? Right?
This goes into the realm of claims. Mm-hmm. So this is more of a legal question, actually.
Interesting.
I don't make any claims around impact. And that goes against the logic. It seems as though I should be, right? It seems as though I should be claiming that our portfolio has reduced X number of CO2 tons, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Well, I want to remind you that we're a pre-seed fund. And like you said yourself, we're backing innovation. We're backing the potential. 9 times out of 10, what would it matter what they measure? They can pivot 10 times and they will. In fact, I actually have to say, frankly, that most of the time we're backing teams that are driven by some greater purpose.
Sure.
And had, you know, I don't want to get into how you, I would measure that. I mean, in fact, I try to, but it's quite difficult. But the real bet is, can this team with a great vision and a passion for what they're building achieve some semblance of impact that sounds like what they aim to back? If I were a government regulator and I wanted to set up a system to make sure that the dollars were going to a measurable, achievable impact at pre-seed, I'd probably quit my job.
Yeah.
because if you understand that any clause you put on founders, any restriction you put on fund managers, any system that you try to standardize, be it B Corp or be it the United Nations Global Reporting Initiative, et cetera, can create massive, massive inefficiencies with a company that has three months of runway.
Yeah. So the constraints essentially will end up killing the business rather than empowering the business to do what it needs to do.
Frankly, the only impact that I feel I could measure or manage is just, do I help create an environment where I help catalyze, basically? And the word catalyze is the word for it. So having said all of that, back to the idea of claims. So in the EU, there's this SFDR program. It's the Sustainable Finance Disclosure Requirements. I believe that's the term for it. And getting a call here, just a moment. They set up this program in EU that basically puts the onus of claims onto the fund manager.
Oh, wow.
And I think that is a mistake. And I think that in a country, in a place where you have massive subsidies for risk taking, i.e. backing fund managers through things like government subsidies or something like that, in that exaggerated world, that could make some sense. If, for example, the US government wanted to give me $100 million to catalyze my early stage fund, okay, I'll hire some people and I'll pay for each of my startups to go through training programs, and we can have a retreat camp and we can all sit down and talk about impact, and we can, you know, whatever it is, set it up, get it to go.
I mean, essentially it's incentivizing the wrong behavior, right?
Well, I didn't say that, but I was being sarcastic to some of you. But just to put this exaggeration to a point.
Yeah.
In the world of high risk, when it's ultra speculative and there are 5 million directions the founders can go, I personally believe that as a fund manager, I would be wasting my founders' time to say, you need to be doing it this way, you need to report it this way. For the first year or two, they should be experimenting, in my opinion. That's my opinion. I think that the ability to experiment and grow and change and pivot is an exercise in trust that a lot of people are not comfortable with, because again, we don't know how to measure trust. It is just a word. And that reconciliation of the personal aspect of impact and building trust with the founding teams and literally just being here to support them and defend them, by the way, not making claims for them, but just defending their pursuits and experimentations and their ability to grow into something that can be a massive financial success. That's my only goal. And I tell my LPs this, and it gets me into trouble with some who think that I should be measuring and monitoring impact in a way that should be a standard or something. I simply don't care. My job is to back innovation.
I mean, there are two things that came out of that for me. So first of all, like on your LP side, I get why they're doing that, right? And the reason they're doing that is, you know, again, depending on
our LPs 100% understand our thesis and they're fully aligned with my motivations. I communicate it incredibly clear to, and that's what, again, why I'd say it in a podcast to redirect them.
Yeah,
but no, there are look, some
I completely get it.
There are some LPs that have a more stringent, rigid approach to traditional impact funds.
Yeah.
They tend to be more concessionary funds because of this friction, though.
Yeah, and what I was kind of leading to is I like as a CFO in some of the ventures that I work with who've taken corporate funding, right, whether it's impact related or not, but often it tends to be impact related. There, so where you have CVCs kind of coming into the fray, like their reporting requirements are massively onerous, right? And often, you know, often around ESG and so on and so forth. And, you know, again, you're talking about 10 person startups.
Yes.
You know, who just
or,
about.
Or,
you know,
two or three person startups.
Or two or three person startups. And you know, like how do you even think about reporting on ESG when, you know, to your point, you're potentially 3 months away from running out of money. And I think
we do pass metrics through strategically where the founders give permission to do so, but because it's very ad hoc and because it can be material at times, I guard the founders however way I can. The LPs are aware of that out of our fund. And as a pre-seed fund, the expectations for that are very low. We're hyper experimental in that sense.
Yeah. And as it should be, I guess, you know, and that, I guess that's kind of the point of the question is that, you know, you answer the question in a different way. You don't track the metrics because, like, you know, the companies are going to pivot, et cetera, puts constraints. But actually, the point
yeah, and it
is,
goes and I, again, it goes back to the 50 to perhaps 500 or 1,000 various impact metrics that could be measured. It's simply a waste of my time. It's a waste of our founders' time at the earliest stage. However, having said that, if impact is it is single impact or dual impact or multiple impacts is the goal of the company, it's strategic, I will never steer them away from it. If it's going to add value to their scale, to their outcome, you know, they have to operate their business. It's not my place to get in the way of the founder's business. If it helps them attract more capital, if it helps them scale, I would never discourage it, frankly.
No, and the point is, again, though, with a lot of those metrics anyway, as I said right at the beginning, time will tell, right? It'll take the 5, 10, 15 years to see kind of what impact is because these things can take time. And in those early stages, as you are pivoting, as you are trying to figure out your go-to-market, as you're trying to figure out product market fit, as you're trying to get in bed with whichever, you know, corporate or consumer or governmental or quasi-statal agency that you're trying to work with, like it is impossible to both do that and measure those things. But once you start...
costly.
Yeah, but once you... Exactly, and massively costly. But once you start generating the revenue, you can start thinking about how you track those things and over time,
Indeed, hopefully show... Yeah, I do have a more of a personal goal. It's not a stated goal on our website or our deck or anything, but I would like in any given sector, I would like our companies that are publicly traded eventually. This is just a goal. My goal would be to hit the target of in the top decile of ESG in any given sector in 10 to 20 plus years. So that's not something I would like pitch to the LPs and say, this is what we're tracking, because it would be very difficult to, that's very far out.
I mean, it's far out, but it's a great objective to have. So moving about on and talking about the kind of wider impact space as far as kind of VC is concerned, like according to a report by Dealroom, funding of impact ventures in 2021 reached $68 billion. And the value of impact businesses, both listed and private, reached well over $2 trillion, which is, you know, astounding over the last couple of years. But impact funding as a total of VC funding is only 8% in the US versus 18% in the Europe, though obviously total dollars invested in the US still outstrips Europe. But given how critical some of the problems that impact ventures are trying to solve are, be it climate, be it financial inclusion, education, healthcare, you know, all those things that we talked about, what in your opinion can be done to drive more dollars into this space as opposed to, say, you know, less socially valuable propositions?
Well, that's a great question. Again, I would say that the idea of an impact versus sustainability focus versus an ESG focus company is going to be interpreted and personalized. So I would say that the true question is whether or not all companies will steer toward something that has more emphasis on a social outcome. I don't think it's that simple. You know, it's a hard question to answer because I actually don't know where to draw the line in a, like, let's say I was wearing the hat of an engineer for a minute. I wouldn't know how to set up the requirements. So it's very complicated. Rather than that, we target the UN SDGs per deal, having up to three UN SDGs that overlap with what I see as an impact focus. You can go onto my website, zekalen.com. You can see in my angel portfolio, I put the SDGs per deal, et cetera. That's also interpretable. Mm-hmm. Wherever there's interpretation and there's not claim, there's going to be subjectivity. There's going to be personalization. So I tend to get less political that way. I tend to not try to make it into an engineering problem and focus more so on how do I help? How do I build more trust? How do I innovate? How do I stimulate more innovation? And I really steer away from the politics as much as possible.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to me, again, I guess this is maybe my personality coming into play.
Like,
if I think about the places I've lived and you know, the environments and societies that I've had contact with, whether that's in New Guinea or Australia, whether that's the UK, yes, elsewhere, like, one has to, you know, you look at what's happening in some of these places. You know, there is massive poverty, there is, you know, definitely, yes, destruction of natural environments.
That's right.
You know, and there are systemic problems, be it around health, that's right, or education, et cetera, et cetera. And I guess my, you know, the altruistic kind of non-CFO part of me is like, oh yeah, we've got to figure out a way of driving more innovation to essentially enhance social, you know, social well-being across the world. And I think I've fallen a little bit into the trap of being, I guess, very rose-tinted when it comes to venture, because I see venture as, and you've said this several times on the podcast, venture as, yes, being the conduit for innovation. Innovation often happens as a byproduct of venture capital, right, of VC investing, but it happens more often than not in VC investing, because you set out to create, you know, outsized financial returns, and in doing so, you often have outsized societal returns, and those may be negative, they may be positive. You are, of course, focused, mm-hmm, on the more positive societal returns, right?
Well, again, I don't want to make any claims at all, and that's the real trick here, is to not make claims and not make forward-looking claims, right, or attach any form of advice to what I'm saying. I'm just deducing something and giving a subjective view on what is currently in my mindset. When you were saying what you're saying about VC and what it catalyzes, I think that all I can really claim is that I'm putting more emphasis on selecting companies and searching for companies and creating content around attracting companies that have more focus on sustainability, impact, social good. Mm. And all that does is it just drives inclusion toward it.
Yeah.
Now, I do filter people away and I say, this is just not for us. It has too many elements of what I would see as social risk, or what I would see. And that's a personal decision that I make on a daily basis, mm, that is very difficult to reconcile sometimes, because, for example, a company may be a high target acquisition. They may get squashed. You know, for strategic purposes, that doesn't help us on a portfolio basis first. That's my first concern. But secondarily, the concern may be that in a case where I'm looking at two opportunities that are the same and one has the ability to get squashed versus the other one, I would probably choose the one that doesn't, the one that has more sort of leeway to scale and exit and become that venture scale positive impact outcome.
Got it.
And that's subjective. There's so many, and so material and so unique to every situation. And that's the other thing. You know, it's easy to talk about what people should be doing when there's not publicly available data, when there's not data that has been given. If someone asked me to share data about all of our research, all of our findings, I wouldn't give it, because I'm guarding even the companies that I that we haven't backed, I'm guarding their going concern.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can only say publicly so much. And that in itself is also an exercise in trust. If we only have data that shows, you know, the worst case scenarios when they happen, or it shows what people's report on a revealed preference basis, and we make policies around that, in my opinion, I feel as though they can create just as many problems as they could create solutions. So in effect, I'm also, as a fund manager that's emphasizing my inclination towards sustainability, I'm asking our LPs or our stakeholders to trust that I have the right intentions, that I show up every day and I do the work to be a good asset allocator, but also to select for things. And again, it goes back to claims. I can't claim that we will have a more positive impact than any other fund on the planet. I wouldn't do that because I'd get into legal hot water. And I think that's part of the reason why Europe has tried to standardize some of these things. However, I will say that really I feel what it can do is it can preclude smaller enterprises such as solo GPs, myself, first-time fund managers, fund managers from an underrepresented background. It can make the friction points harder to enter the system, which in effect creates more of the problems that we've seen before. It's like the road to hell is paved with good intentions. It's, you know, once you have a bureaucracy in place, the higher probability of a next bureaucracy can also go up.
You just keep up, you stack the constraints on top of each other and just make entry almost impossible. Zeka, it's been absolutely incredible speaking to you.
I feel like
there is about, you know, a good sort of 6 hours of additional content that we could probably create. And I have...
Please collaborate more with me. I can't wait to do more Twittering with you and all the rest.
I would absolutely love that for one. But for our audience, where can they find you? You're on Twitter, obviously.
Yes, thank you. Yes, responsibly.vc. Also on Twitter, responsibly.vc at Zeka Len. We also have a community called Positive with an eye to eye in the middle, focused on venture scale positive impacts. So we have about 10,000 people. We have some sub communities, and always I'm looking to engage you with our community as well.
I started onboarding onto response, onto the platform rather. I think my ADHD maybe got in the way, and I kind of got halfway through. So I need to pick that up.
Oh, I need to shorten it. Too much work is never the answer.
No, that's just me. That's absolutely just me. But look, Zeka, it's been absolutely lovely having you with me here today on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.